Hey, Prime members, you can listen to The Vanished ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
We didn't know anything about him. You know, my parents weren't aware of him at all until later. It was 8 months later that he attacked one of his neighbors, and that's when, you know, he came on my parents' radar, and that was because she survived the attack, and she came out and said, well, you know, he did it. He took Mikkel.
Eleven-year-old Mikkel Biggs disappeared from her Mesa, Arizona neighborhood on January 2, 1999. She had been playing outside with her younger sister, Kimber. Mikkel was riding Kimber's bike while Kimber had their dog on a leash. The two were waiting for an ice cream truck that they could hear in the distance. Kimber started to get cold and decided to give up on the ice cream truck. She returned home and her mom told her to go back and tell Mikkel that it was time to come in. It was getting dark. Investigators estimate that Kimber was only gone for about 90 seconds. And in that 90 seconds, Mikkel disappeared. Kimber found her bike on the ground with the tire still spinning, and the quarters that Mikkel had been holding for the ice cream truck were on the ground not far from her bike. What happened to Mikkel in those 90 seconds? She has now been missing for almost 20 years, and no trace of her has ever been found. I'm Marissa, and from Wondery, this is episode 123 of The Vanished. Audible offers thousands of popular favorites, exclusive new series, guided wellness programs, comedy, and exciting new voices in audio. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog. The Audible app makes it easy to listen anytime, anywhere, while traveling, working out, walking, doing chores, you decide. I like to listen a little bit each evening while I'm cooking dinner, and it's great for my evening walks too. Recently, I've been listening to Lay Them to Rest by Laura Norton. It's a fantastic audiobook. You don't want to miss it. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. That's audible.com/MIA or text MIA to 500-500. Kimber contacted me several months ago to see if I would cover Mikkel's case. She's been pushing really hard for answers over the past few years. I was already aware of Mikkel's case because it's one that I personally have followed for many years. There's something so puzzling about how a person can be taken in such a short time frame without anyone seeing or hearing a thing. 11-year-old Mikkel was the oldest of her siblings, then Kimber, who was 9, 5-year-old Nathan, and their baby sister Linnell, who was just 9 months old. Leading up to Mikkel's disappearance, she was busy doing all of the things that kids her age do. She was an honor student at Lindbergh Elementary School, but she was on break for the holidays, so the 2 nights before she went missing, she had a sleepover at a friend's house. She returned home on the 2nd and was there with her mom, her 3 siblings, and some relatives who were visiting. Nothing seemed out of the ordinary that day. Later that evening, Mikkel and Kimber went outside together. Mikkel was on Kimber's bike while Kimber walked their dog on a leash. Kimber told me what she can remember from that evening.
She was riding my bike that I had just gotten for my birthday that previous year. You know, it was evening time, 6, I want to say. And, you know, all the neighborhood kids had been playing outside and it was January, so it was getting cold and kids started going inside for dinner. And I got cold. We were waiting for the ice cream truck and, you know, it never came over and I got impatient and I was getting cold and I knew the street lights were coming on soon, which meant that, you know, that was our curfew. So I decided to go inside. I told her I was cold and I didn't want to wait for the ice cream truck anymore. And she didn't care. She wanted to wait a little longer and kept riding the bike. And so I, you know, turned and walked down the street and went to the house. I remember I was standing across the street from our house, and I had to, you know, look down the road to cross the street. And I looked and, you know, I saw her writing, and then I looked the other way and crossed. And that was the last time I saw her, was when I went to cross the road. And I walked up to my house. I walked in through the garage that was open, and I opened like the garage door. And before I could even get inside and complain to my mom, she told me to tell Mikkel that it was, you know, getting dark and it was dinner time and to have her come in. And so, of course, I'm irritated that I had to walk all the way back to the house for to turn around and walk back. So I turn around and I kind of go out to the end of the driveway, and I yelled for her because I didn't want to have to walk to the end of the street again. It was about three houses down where she was riding. And, you know, I yelled for her that it was time to come in, and I looked and I didn't see her. And so I kind of went out a little bit further to like look down further down the street, and I could see something in the road, and I couldn't tell what it was really. And as I walked closer, I realized it was my bike in the road. It was about like a foot and a half from the curb. And as I got closer to it, the back tire, I could see the tire was still spinning on the bike. It was a weird feeling. I was confused for sure. I didn't know why she left my bike in the road. I didn't know where she was. And I was mad because she left my bike in the road. So even though my main focus was anger and I was yelling at her, yelling into the air that I was going to tell on her, you know, there was just that subconscious feeling that something was eerie, something was off. And I picked up my bike and I, you know, walked back to the house. I had the bike and the dog with me. So I had to walk back to the house, and I went through the side gate and, you know, put my bike and the dog away and went inside and told my mom that Mikkel left my bike in the road and I don't know where she went. And my mom was like, okay, well, maybe she went over to the neighbor's house to play. Their house was at the end of the street and she was riding just past their house. So I turned around and went back over to their house, and they said they hadn't seen her. And they said she was just out here riding her bike. And I said she left my bike in the road. I don't know where she went. And I believe it was their oldest son came out to help me look for her. And at the time, and I don't recall this because I didn't know this is what happened, but I guess he found her her money from the ice cream truck. Found some quarters on the ground. And, you know, they were like sprawled out, and I could tell he seemed worried, but I didn't really understand at that moment. And he said, go home and tell your mom we can't find Mikkel. And so I went home and I told her, I said, we can't find Mikkel. That's kind of where it gets blurry. I remember my mom's face, you know, her face kind of dropped and she went pale. You could tell it was instant. She knew Mikkel was missing. And that was the second that I realized that maybe something happened. And everything from there kind of gets fuzzy, but I know within 30 minutes, you know, my dad was home, the police were there, and there was 100 people forming search parties and going door to door.
Mikkel's case was not one that was ignored by the public or law enforcement. The search was massive. The police spared no resources, and members of the community came out to help in any way that they could.
It gets really fuzzy from there on, like that night. They started going door to door with the search parties, and I'm pretty sure that mostly everyone was willing to let people come in and look around. And, you know, when they would go door to door, then more people would come out and help, kind of thing. I'm not sure to what extent, like how far they went in the search party, or like how thorough the houses were searched, since it was just volunteers. I don't know about that, but I do know that they definitely went and searched people's houses. And I guess my mom had her cousin visiting, and like a couple of her cousins. So when I said, we can't find Mikkel, they jumped in their truck and started driving the neighborhood looking for her while my mom called the police and my dad.
When search dogs were brought to the scene, they were able to pick up Mikkel's scent, but lost it after a few feet. That has led investigators to believe that Mikkel had been placed into a vehicle.
I think it was within 3 feet that they lost her scent. You know, they determined that she was definitely pulled into a vehicle and, you know, they drove off with her. I forget if they knew what direction the vehicle went or anything. I don't think they actually determined that.
No one saw what happened to Mikkel, but people came forward giving tips about anything they had seen that was out of the ordinary or possibly suspicious.
Yeah, there were a lot of possibilities. I know there were quite a few descriptions. People's names would come up, or neighbors would mention a car from, you know, that they'd seen a while ago or something, but they were all investigated and, you know, nothing was found of them. It was nothing substantial. I think it was more just people were trying to give anything that might help, but there wasn't like a definite suspicious vehicle that everyone kind of thought of.
Police tracked down those leads, but nothing significant ever came from them. We know that when kids go missing, the parents are always looked at, and Mikkel's case was no different. Mikkel's dad wasn't home when she disappeared, so they focused in on him initially. He agreed to take a polygraph, but failed. Investigators have said that it's quite possible that he failed because he was so emotional over the disappearance of his daughter. It was frustrating for the family to have Mikkel's father focused on when they believed that he wasn't involved in her disappearance. You've heard other families mention this on the show. They know they need to be ruled out, but it can feel like a waste of time and resources knowing that the person responsible is still out there. But even with his frustrations, he always cooperated with law enforcement. He was eventually cleared of any suspicion. Detectives believe that it would have been impossible for him to be responsible with the small window of time that he had before he was on scene searching.
It's hard not to hold resentment in that situation. I think it was a waste of time, a waste of resources. He was constantly, you know, battered in lie detector tests and everything, and he was under so much stress and, you know, he was miserable and terrified his daughter was missing. And I know that in a lot of young children, when they go missing, the parents are generally the first ones that are looked at. I know that's very common. But I feel like they took it too far. I feel like there was far too much focus on it, and it could have, you know, had time and resources better spent.
The Mesa Police Department continued to follow up on leads and track down thousands of tips that they received. Just as we often see with some of these higher profile cases, some of the leads turned out to be hoaxes. They traveled far and wide to follow these leads, but then something happened. Something that made everyone realize that there was someone dangerous very close to home. On September 27, 1999, about 8 months after Mikkel had vanished, a 42-year-old woman living in the same neighborhood was brutally attacked inside her home. She came home to find a man waiting inside for her. He had been hiding behind her refrigerator with his pants unzipped, exposing himself. He beat and raped her, then set a fire inside of her home. Despite having severe injuries, including a broken neck, she survived and was able to call for help. The man who attacked her also lived in the same neighborhood. His name is Dee Blaylock, and he was a registered sex offender. He had been convicted in 3 different states for crimes against women and children. When Blaylock was interviewed by the police, he claimed that he hadn't attacked his neighbor and said, "See now, don't get me wrong. I've done a lot of things in my life, okay, and I'm not proud of them. But there's one thing I've never done, and you can look back on my record. I've never on any of my rapes, my child molesting, any of that, ever hit one of them." They were able to find Blaylock's DNA on his victim and her DNA in his underwear. He was convicted of sexual assault, aggravated assault, sexual abuse, kidnapping, and burglary. Blaylock received a 187-year sentence for this crime. The Biggs family had no idea that this predator was living so close to them until this attack happened.
Yeah, we didn't know anything about him. You know, my parents weren't aware of him at all until later. It was 8 months later that he attacked one of his neighbors, and that's when, you know, he came on my parents' radar, and that was because she survived the attack, and she came out and said, "Well, you know, he did it. He took Mikkel." He never told her that he did. She just felt that way, I guess. That was her belief. And I don't think she ever explained why she felt that way. She just said he was responsible. Since the attack on her was so brutal, that's when the police thought maybe he could be responsible, and that's when they went back.
Kimber explained to me just how close Blaylock lived to their home.
I would say maybe a quarter of a mile. We lived on a street, it was called El Moro. Mikel was riding her bike in the T in the road of El Moro and Toltec. And then he lived on Toltec about, you know, the road kind of curved around and he lived kind of at the end of the road where it curved. So from his house, you couldn't see where she was riding on the corner. But as soon as you come around, if you were driving on the road, as soon as you come around that bend, you could see her kind of thing. So yeah, I would say it was probably a quarter mile.
We all know there are things in life that you have to compromise on, but when it comes to your health, there's no compromise. So don't settle for that one doctor that isn't really addressing your needs. Instead, check out ZocDoc, the place where you can find and book doctors who will make you feel comfortable. And you can even search by location, availability, and insurance. ZocDoc is a free app and website where you can search and compare highly rated in-network doctors near you and instantly book appointments with them online. Once you find the doc you want, you can book them immediately. You can filter specifically for ones who take your insurance, are located near you, and treat basically any condition you're searching for. The typical wait time to see a doctor booked on ZocDoc is between just 24 and 72 hours. That's it. I use this and you should too. Go to ZocDoc.com/vanished and download the ZocDoc app for free. Then find and book a top-rated doctor today. That's ZocDoc.com/vanished. ZocDoc.com/vanished. This message is sponsored by Greenlight. When you're a parent, you'll have your fair share of big talks with your kids. One of those big talks should involve money, and Greenlight can help with that. Greenlight is a debit card and money app for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. I've been using Greenlight with my older two kids for years. One thing that I love about it is that I can set up recurring or one-time chores, customized to my family's needs, and then my kids earn an allowance to reward them for a job well done. Not only does it motivate them to actually get the chores done, but it also teaches them a bit about financial literacy and independence. They're learning to earn, save, and spend wisely. So stop putting off the money talk and start putting your kids on the right path. Sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free at greenlight.com/vanished. That's greenlight.com/vanished to try Greenlight for free. One more time, that's greenlight.com/vanished. One thing about Blaylock is that he doesn't have a defined victim profile. He didn't just go after women. He had abused children before, too.
I do know that his victims, like, he wasn't picky with his victims. Boy, girl, adult, child, it was anyone, basically. And they were all, you know, crimes of just the sexual nature. They were not violent crimes at that point. And they later, I guess, determined that when they believed that he was responsible for Mikel, that that's really when he kind of snapped and went from just sexual crimes to violent crimes, and then that's what led him to brutally attack his neighbor Susan Quinnett. He was hiding in her house when she came home, and he like jumped out and attacked her, like beat and raped her, and then I guess he left, like he put boxes or something on the stove or in the oven or so that they would catch fire, and left her unconscious in a burning house, and she miraculously survived and escaped, and of course, you know, identified him.
While I was talking to Kimber, I couldn't help but wonder if anyone else in the neighborhood had ever considered Blaylock to be threatening before he attacked his neighbor. Did the kids ever notice him watching them?
For me personally, I was not aware of him. I don't believe I ever met him. I don't believe my parents knew him. I'm not sure about other people in the neighborhood. From what I know, I think he kept a pretty low profile and pretty much no one really knew him or knew much about him or had much contact with him to get any kind of sense of worry, I guess. I didn't know at the time before Mikel was taken, I didn't know where he lived or anything, but you know, we used to ride our bikes around the whole neighborhood. And I remember I always used to ride my bike down Toltec, and his house kind of was set back. The road divoted a little bit. And instead of riding in front of his house, I would always cross the street at that point. And I don't know why. I just always did that. I didn't want to ride in front of that house. It was creepy for some reason. And it was years later that I found out that that's where he lived. That's kind of my only experience with thinking he was creepy. And I didn't even know it was him, and I never saw him. It was just the house gave me a creepy feeling, and I would not ride my bike in front of it.
Before Mikkel's disappearance, she had taken piano lessons from one of their neighbors, who just so happened to live right across the street from Dee Blaylock. Many wonder if he could have noticed her coming and going to her lessons. When Mikkel went missing, the police did go and speak to all of the sex offenders in the area, including Blaylock.
Since he was a registered sex offender at the time of Mikkel's disappearance, I believe his house was searched, and they, you know, got an alibi from him. His wife had said he was home and in the garage or on the carport working on his car or truck or whatever it was. And then 8 months later, when he was arrested for this attack, I believe that's when she recanted her statement and said that, you know, well, actually I left the house and he went on a beer run, and I don't know where he was for this hour and a half. And that's really when they started to investigate him, and they were never able to find substantial evidence against him. So I guess he can't officially be named a suspect, but it is believed that he was responsible. It made the most sense.
It's interesting to note that when his wife changed her story, she said that he had gone for a beer run the day that Mikkel disappeared. That's exactly what he claimed he was doing when he attacked his neighbor inside her home. He had told police that he went on a beer run to a local Texaco, and then to the grocery store to pick up some flowers. When Blaylock was initially spoken to, they were able to search his house, but there was a trailer on his property that they couldn't search without a warrant. They did eventually get a warrant for the trailer, but by that time, the trailer was gone.
I believe since he was a registered sex offender, they went to his house that night, but they couldn't search the trailer. I don't know if they thought to search the trailer at that time or not, but then 8 months later, when he actually was being investigated, they went, they wanted to check out the trailer, and he had sold it at that point. And when it was tracked down, it had been, completely cleaned out, and, they had forensics and everything in there, and they couldn't find anything. There was no blood or hair or nothing that could give them anything. It had been so long and it had been cleaned. But there was a storage unit right out. If you took the road he lived on, if you took Toltec, it kind of led out of the neighborhood. There was a self-storage that was there. And I guess the owner there kind of just let him use whatever storage unit was available at the time. He didn't have a set unit number that could be searched. And there was no way to determine which one he was using at the time that she was taken. I don't know if he actually took the trailer to the storage unit. I think that is the speculation.
The trailer has been a dead end, but many people believe that Mikkel could have been inside that trailer when the police initially searched the area. The Biggs family believes that Blaylock is responsible for Mikkel's disappearance. They wrote to him in prison with the hope that he would speak. What did he have to lose at this point? Well, Blaylock wrote them back.
It was the letter was almost a tease. He did say something that led them to believe that maybe he would admit guilt or knew something.
Mikkel's parents went and visited Blaylock in prison. Convinced that he was responsible, they hoped he'd decide to come clean.
They did. They went and talked to him, I believe just the one time, and they had exchanged letters. And then, he agreed to see them. From what I understand, he retained innocence and acted like he didn't know much and, I'm so sorry that happened kind of attitude, and, wouldn't give my parents anything. Despite that, my parents came out of that feeling like he was responsible. They just got that feeling. They said the way he acted, the way he talked, his body language and everything, he seemed like he did it. And when I spoke with the detectives about Blaylock, they said that he's a habitual liar. And he claims to have multiple personalities and that he can't be responsible for what one of his other personalities does. And even when he's been presented with proof of past crimes of anything he's done, he's completely denied that he did it.
At this point, they're basically at a standstill with Blaylock because they don't have enough evidence to move forward with a case against him, but he stands out because he did live so close and has such a dangerous history.
I believe they cannot make an official statement because there's no evidence to name him a suspect, but they do feel that he's responsible. The detectives back then, and I believe everyone who's, you know, as detectives, you know, retire or move to other departments, the case gets handed off to the next person kind of thing. And everyone who's had a chance to be on this case has kind of felt the same way, but they just aren't really supposed to say that. They're, you know, they can't name him a suspect because there is no evidence, but it is kind of unspoken that he's responsible.
Over the years, some other theories have been tossed around. One that many people go back to is the ice cream truck. Could someone driving an ice cream truck have taken her or even hit her on the bike? The bike wasn't damaged, though, so it didn't appear that she had been hit. There was also a theory that someone could have been playing ice cream truck music to lure children.
It was a speculation for a while, and people still just kind of believe that. It's not the case, though. There was an ice cream truck. We lived next to a high school, and the ice cream truck was behind the high school on the other side, so we could hear it from our neighborhood, but it never actually came into, like, our subdivision. So I know that it was kind of a thought, and I personally thought that for longer than even the detectives did, just because I was young and, you know, my parents weren't exactly giving me every single lead and tip in the case. So I think just the fact that it was a possibility for a short time, it's just one of those instances where people took it and ran with it.
The police did check out all the ice cream trucks in the area, but like everything else in this case, it was a dead end.
They determined that there was definitely not an ice cream truck on our street or in our subdivision, and that all ice cream trucks in the area, and I don't know what radius, how far they checked, but all the ice cream trucks in the area were investigated, and, you know, their trucks were checked and they were questioned and they were vetted from, they were cleared. But yeah, they definitely looked into every one of them.
One of the most bizarre aspects of Mikkel's disappearance is how someone was able to abduct her in such a short amount of time without anyone seeing or hearing a thing.
Yeah, they determined she was alone for less than 90 seconds. It was evening time, but it wasn't dark. The sun was still kind of out, so it's not like this was in a dark corner. It was in a street that kids played in regularly, and 90 seconds is not a lot of time to drive a car up, grab, and drive off without being noticed. It's something that I still, you know, ask myself about constantly. How is this possible? The way the street was set up, the two houses on the end face Toltec, so there were fences right there. So, you know, depending on exactly where she was, the houses on El Moro wouldn't have been able to see her, but there was a house right there that right at the end of the T that faced right where she was riding. And, you know, had they looked out their window or opened their door or anything, they definitely would have seen what happened. And I believe those people we knew pretty well. I think they were in our church group, but they had just gotten home from work or something. You know, it wasn't long before I walked back to my house that they were outside as well. It was literally just that small window that everyone just happened to not be outside or in the window or opening, closing doors, which was very common. There was always people coming in and out, and kids were always on the street. And it was kind of just unspoken that all the parents would kind of just come out and keep an eye on the kids, you know, kind of peek out at them, make sure everything was okay. And it was just that a fluke, basically, that how at that one moment, no one looked, no one was looking.
One thing that Mikkel's family decided to do after she had been missing for 5 years was to have a funeral for her. They were hoping that this would give them a sense of closure and peace. Families often mention to me how hard it is to not have closure and a gravesite to visit. I can understand why this was important to them, but they've also been criticized for making this decision.
people think that since we had a funeral that we've given up and that we don't want to find her or anything. It's very hard not to take it personally because they are making it personal. They're judging me for what I'm choosing to do to try and cope with the situation. And I would never wish this situation on my worst enemy, but they have no idea. They don't know. And I'm glad that they don't know and they don't understand it, that they've never been through this, but it makes it extremely hard to communicate that to them. You know, some people are just so set in their own ways and the way they think that there is no communicating and trying to make them understand how offensive what they're saying is. We do feel she passed. You know, it's just that feeling, and I've tried to explain it to people before. If you've never lost someone close to you, maybe you don't know what it's like, but you get that empty feeling. You know, you can feel it in your soul that something is missing and that, you know, she's passed. And it's just little things that make me feel like she is no longer with us. You know, I feel like I've felt her presence, which maybe is weird to say, but people don't always understand that. And the funeral definitely was for a sense of closure. It wasn't, the case wasn't closed at that point. It was just that it went from actively searching for a missing child to actively looking for who did this. That's really the turning point for what the case was. And people don't understand that. The funeral was definitely for a sense of closure. I think more for my parents than anything. They wanted to have a place to go visit her, essentially. And we have gone to her gravesite before. We go there once in a while. When my parents lived here, we would go, or they would go on their own. And I still go there once in a while. And it's nice to have like a dedicated spot when you just want to go and think about her. Or we've gone and told stories and shared memories about her, like on her birthday. And we played some of her favorite songs and we had cupcakes with, you know, purple frosting because that's her favorite color. It helps our family grieve because in this situation, it's, you know, it's a unique situation. There is no grieving because grief is supposed to come after the answers, and we haven't gotten any.
The Vanished is sponsored by BetterHelp. With social gatherings picking up after the winter, it can be easy to ignore your social battery and spread yourself thin. It's a good time to think about the right amount of socializing for you. Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you prefer more alone time. Therapy can give you the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. A therapist can help you learn how to set boundaries so you feel empowered to be the best version of yourself. Everyone can benefit from therapy. It's not just for those who've experienced major trauma. So if you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online, so it's designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists anytime for no additional charge. Find your social sweet spot with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/vanished today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/vanished.
Kimber runs a Facebook page for Mikkel, and she hopes that by keeping her sister's story out there, it may eventually reach someone who knows something.
I originally actually started the page. It was called Remember Mikkel Biggs, and I just started it for my own place to talk about her. You know, I spent many years not talking about her. I got a lot of criticism from my peers that they, you know, would say I just wanted attention, and I kind of learned that I couldn't talk about it. And so I started that page to kind of overcome that. It turned into something so much more. You know, the page got more attention than I expected it would. And that's when I changed the page name from Remember Mikkel Biggs to Justice for Mikkel Biggs. And it's just taken off from there. And it's really what has led me into being her advocate now. after my parents did the 2020 interview in 2010, I believe, that was kind of their last time in the spotlight. That was when they were really just, it was too much at that point. And they had to take a step back. And then after that is when, you know, I decided I was ready, really, to do something about it. I believe, not for any particular reason, but I do just believe that we will have answers. And, you know, I hope that it's as a result of things that I am doing now. You know, I hope that it's what I'm doing makes a difference. Like I said, I'm trying to be her advocate, and I feel like it's just a matter of reaching people. The more people that are aware, maybe reaching that person who really touched them to make them feel for our family. You know, maybe it's just a matter of doing that, and I'm hoping that that's all it's going to take. And, you know, I don't know how long, but I do feel that I will find answers.
If Blaylock is responsible for Mikkel's disappearance, is it possible that he acted alone and never confided in anyone else? Maybe someone he knew noticed something suspicious. There's always a possibility that someone may know something and not even realize that it's important.
That would be our best case. I don't know how anyone could go almost, you know, 20 years without saying anything to anyone, even unintentionally, you know, just letting something slip. It doesn't seem likely. So I think that our best chance at figuring out what happened is not through Dee Blaylock himself, but someone who he may have confided in or someone who found something out and they have that information.
With a case like this one that has received a lot of media attention over the years, it pulls in many people who want to help, but we often see the darker side of the internet sleuthing community too. Even though the police department has investigated Mikkel's father and were able to clear him of any suspicion, there are people out there who still cling to that theory. While I was preparing to cover this case, I was seeing Kimber fighting some of these attacks on Facebook.
The trolls, they like to try and bring that up, and I've gotten to where when they do that, I will just tag my dad, and I tell them, if you want to talk like that about my dad, you can say it to him. And that usually makes them stop, because he is very good at logically letting people know. And that generally makes them back up. And I've actually had people delete their comments and block me and my dad because they didn't want to face him, essentially. And I hate it. It is frustrating. That keeps getting brought up for my dad. I can't speak for him. I don't know how he deals with it, really, but I'm sure it's not a pleasant feeling. And it's hard on me when people bring it up and act like he is still suspect. I can only imagine how much harder it is for him. It's weird to me that people still think he would be responsible, even though when you look at the facts, it makes no sense. Definitely ignorance at its finest. They spread misinformation. They take their opinion, they state it as fact, and then they want everyone to know it. And I don't think they realize that not only does that make them, you know, an insensitive person, but that's hurting the case. When people believe that we've given up, when people believe that the case is closed, and they believe that my dad is responsible, then that's only hurting it, because then no one will come forward. No one will help, because they will think it's pointless. You know, I had people harassing me online, saying horrible things. It's more common than I was aware of, I'm sure. It's just been recently that I'm seeing how bad it is. And, you know, if you Google Mikkel Biggs, endless amounts of information and stories pop up. Sometimes, you know, I go down that rabbit hole and I start clicking on link after link, and I'm reading comments after comment after comment. And a lot of people, like I said, it's ignorance. They spread misinformation.
Earlier this year, there was a development in Mikkel's case. A dollar bill was found in Wisconsin that said, "My name is Mikkel Biggs, kidnapped from Mesa, Arizona. I'm alive." Mikkel's name was spelled incorrectly on the dollar bill, and Kimber told me that she thinks this is probably just another dead end.
Personally, we do not believe that Mikkel would have written it, or that even it came, you know, from Mikkel, that someone else wrote it and for her kind of thing. That's been speculation of people online, I guess. Our family does not personally believe that, but our hope, and I've said before, best case scenario, it's someone who knows something and they wrote it in hopes to help. Maybe they're nervous about coming forward or don't think that they actually know anything. You know, it could be a million different things, but best case scenario, it leads us to someone who knows something. And worst case scenario, it's a hoax. And I personally, at this point, I do believe it is just someone playing a cruel joke. It is being investigated, but I haven't heard anything as of yet. Nothing has come of it so far. So I believe that it was just someone who decided to mess with our family for, you know, God knows why.
When someone goes missing, it deeply affects everyone close to the case. Kimber was just 9 years old, and she was the last person to see her sister before she disappeared. I wanted to hear from her how this has affected her life, experiencing such a tragedy from the perspective of a child.
Well, at the time, you know, I was nine. I was the last one to see her. I was the one that left her when she was riding the bike on the street. I immediately went to guilt. I blamed myself completely. If I hadn't left her alone, then this wouldn't have happened, kind of thing. I know a few days after it happened, I talked to my mom about that, and I told her that I felt like it was my fault. And, you know, she told me, you don't know that. Like, it's not your fault. It's the person who took her, and, you know, they could have taken both of you. And, you know, she kind of explained and tried to comfort me and everything, and I let it go, and I never really mentioned it again, because in my mind, it didn't matter how I felt. I always put my needs second to Mikkel, because it was more important to find her than it was to deal with myself. Though I had good intentions, that was definitely, I believe, a very damaging approach to take. And even to this day, I'm still learning and trying to figure out how to not do that to myself and to take care of myself and how to cope with it and how to live day to day and not beat up myself, I guess.
Kimber is now a mom herself, and the events of that January day, almost 20 years ago, have also affected her as a parent.
Definitely, 100%. It has everything to do with the way a parent. I am a helicopter mom to a T. I mean, I take my son to the park, and he is dressed in neon colors so that I can see him from far away. And if he's on the playground and he goes behind the structure and I can't see him, I get up and walk around to the other side so that I can make sure I see him. If we're at the mall and I take him to go play in the play area, he's not allowed to leave the closed off play area at all. And I'm the one walking, you know, it's a small enclosed area, and I'm still walking around to make sure I can see where he is playing. And I am more aware when we go places, you know, walking through parking lots, especially at night. You know, I'm very aware of what cars I park by, who's around me. It sounds like I'm crazy paranoid, but I check I look over my shoulder everywhere I go. And, you know, just simple grocery store trips that no one else even thinks to be alert for. I'm aware of who's walking next to me in the grocery store, who's around the corner, who just came onto the aisle I'm on, who's walking out the door when I'm walking out, who's getting in their car near me, even when my son's not with me, but it's even more so when he is.
So what happened to Mikkel Biggs on January 2nd, 1999? The Biggs family is convinced that Dee Blaylock is responsible. I can completely understand why they feel that way. He had victimized both women and children. We also know that he was comfortable striking close to home since he attacked a neighbor just months after Mikkel vanished. Could he have been watching Mikkel and other kids in the neighborhood? Or maybe he just saw that short window of opportunity when Kimber went inside for those 90 seconds. We also know that there were other sex offenders in the area. The police had spoken to 20 of them when Mikkel first went missing. There's also a possibility that there could be a predator out there who has never been identified. There's still hope that there could be someone out there who knows something. Maybe the person responsible has confided in someone or slipped up at some point along the line. While I was researching Mikkel's case, I thought about something that happened to me when I was the same age. I had always wanted my own dog, and I finally got a puppy for my 11th birthday. My parents had one condition. I had to take care of her myself. I would walk her every day after school. While I was on my walks, a man started to stop and chat with me. I was uncomfortable with this man, but I had always been taught to treat grown-ups with respect. I also noticed that he had a car seat in his car. In my 11-year-old mind, that made me think that he was safe because he was a dad. One day, he tried to convince me to get into his car. I told him that I needed to walk my dog, but he was persistent. I became so alarmed that I began running with my puppy. My mom called the police, but I never saw the man again, and as far as I know, they never figured out who he was. When I reflect back on that, I realize how easily I could have become a victim. I think many of us have had experiences like this at some point in our lives. Even though stranger abductions are rare, there are predators out there looking for an opportunity. Covering cases of missing kids can be distressing, especially as a parent myself with an 11-year-old at home. But every time someone hears Mikkel's story, I hope that it serves as a reminder to stay vigilant. If you would like to follow Mikkel's case on social media, Kimber runs Justice for Mikkel Biggs on Facebook. Before I go, I want to give an update on two recent cases. I covered Jameson Lemons in episode 122. If you haven't heard his episode yet, you may want to fast forward through this. I had interviewed his mom, Jamie, back in January, and I waited hoping that there would be a DNA match to that tooth that was found. Just days after the episode aired, the match finally came. That led to the arrest of Justin Jameson, who was charged with murder and concealing a death. The Effingham County Sheriff's Department is still hoping to recover more remains, and they're looking for information that anyone may have on this case. The second case that I want to give you an update on is from episode 108, when I covered the disappearance of Zachary Kennedy. On May 3rd, 2018, detectives executed a search warrant at the home where Zachary was last seen. While digging in the yard, they located human remains. On May 9th, the medical examiner confirmed that the body recovered was Zachary. They have not yet determined his cause of death, and no arrest has been made. This is also still an active investigation. As sad as these updates are, I'm very hopeful that justice will be served in both of these cases. That brings us to the end of episode 123. I'd like to thank Kimber for taking the time to speak with me. If you have a missing loved one that you'd like to have featured on the show, there's a case submission form at thevanishedpodcast.com. If you'd like to contact me, there's a page and a discussion group on Facebook. I'm on Twitter at thevanishedpod and also on Instagram. If you enjoy this show, subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Wondery.com, or wherever you're listening right now. Do you want to help support The Vanished? There are a couple things that you can do. Rate and review on Apple Podcasts. Your 5-star reviews help other people find the show. Another way to help is to fill out a short survey at Wondery.com/survey. Join me next week. I'll be covering a case from Wisconsin. Thanks for listening.
Definitely let people know that we are still searching, we haven't given up, and that I'm willing to do what it takes to get to the point of getting my sister justice.
In 2007, TV network, CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.
It's all a lighthearted nightmare on our podcast, Morbid.
We're your hosts. I'm Alina Urquhart.
And I'm Ash Kelly.
And our show is part true crime, part spooky, and part comedy.
The stories we cover are well-researched.
He claimed and confessed to officially killing up to 28 people.
With a touch of humor.
I'd just like to go ahead and say that if there's no band called Malevolent Deity,
that is pretty great.
A dash of sarcasm and just garnished a bit with a little bit of cursing.
This motherfucker lied.
Like a liar.
Like a liar.
And if you're a weirdo like us and love to cozy up to a creepy tale of the paranormal,
or you love to hop in the Wayback Machine and dissect the details of some of history's most notorious crimes,
you should tune in to our podcast, Morbid. Follow Morbid on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to episodes early and ad-free by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.